listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The 9/11 attacks were a global event, so when it came time to rebuild on the site and to create a memorial, the project's concerns transcended matters like property deeds and architecture and expanded into thinking about a way to bring closure to this chapter in our history. The only catch? Well, not everyone agrees on what that closure should look like. In a book called The Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center, urban anthropologist Elizabeth Greenspan describes the controversy surrounding the rebuilding efforts. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm very pleased that it brings Elizabeth Greenspan to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Weren't you studying the kinds of issues that 9/11 would bring up at the time of the attacks?
I was. I was a graduate student at the time in Philadelphia, and I was interested in cities and how they rebuild after violence and disaster. And so I was reading about Berlin and Hiroshima, Oklahoma City. And then 9/11 happened. And, you know, within weeks, everyone was asking, how do we rebuild? What do we put here?
Did you see this situation as analogous to those other places?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the violence was different. The kind of devastation was different. It wasn't a war zone in the way we think of. But we had, you know, there was this demand and this desire to rebuild very quickly.
Well, you came here, I'm sure, with certain ideas, certain notions about what has to be done and what will be done. Mm-hmm. How soon were you disabused?
Yeah, I mean, very quickly it was clear that there were many groups who had very strong feelings about what should happen. And so it was a debate, you know, from the get-go, I mean, within weeks. And that was one of the things that made it so interesting.
You write that at the World Trade Center site, the question of ownership was pretty clear-cut, mm-hmm. on paper at least. The Port Authority owned the land. Larry Silverstein owned the lease to the office space. How did the idea of ownership of that space grow larger than those two entities?
Yeah, the question of ownership is really the key question for me in the book. Because as you say, legally it was very clear, but so many other groups felt like the land belonged to them in some way. So you had victims' families who felt like they should have a say in what should happen there and felt strongly about a memorial. But you also had residents who lived near the area and, you know, felt strongly about what their neighborhood looked like. You had architects in the city, and you had Americans around the country who also felt like this land was now historic.
And people around the world. Everybody seems to have a sense that they own Ground Zero.
Exactly.
As we've seen in some other things that have turned up, like the big dispute over the Islamic Cultural
right.
Center blocks away.
Yes, absolutely.
It was a big issue all over this country. Larry Silverstein received nearly 3,000 letters in the month after the attacks with suggestions on what to replace the space with. What were the most popular suggestions?
Some people were telling him to rebuild. And there were, you know, some for many years who wanted to rebuild the Twin Towers exactly as they were.
They had not been admired buildings before. Now suddenly
right.
they were the most beloved buildings in America?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think afterwards they really became a symbol, a different kind of symbol than anyone could have imagined before. And people thought that the only way to respond was to return the skyline to exactly what it looked like before. And then there were others who wanted art buildings and centers and a very significant memorial, of course.
And many people saw this as an opportunity to kind of to revive the downtown area, which was going into mm-hmm. a certain amount of, I don't know what word I want to use, but the rental spaces were going
yeah.
unused. And there was a feeling that if you brought some arts to the downtown area, that would revive the whole area.
Yeah. One of the, like you said, the Twin Towers were not beloved buildings, and architects in particular disliked the super block trend that had characterized the 60s and 70s. And so they saw 9/11, a sort of silver lining after 9/11 would be to correct those mistakes and to put the streets back through the site again, create more street life, more active public spaces.
How had the Port Authority gained agency over that part of Lower Manhattan in the first place?
It was controversial at the time, back in the 60s, but they worked with the Rockefeller brother to create the World Trade Center, and they took ownership of that land in a deal back in the 60s. And
it had been the radio center.
It had been the radio center, exactly.
It probably would have gone under anyway because of, I mean, no, people were no longer buying tubes for
sure.
their radios.
Yeah, but there were, you know, thousands of stores there, a lot of immigrant-owned mom-and-pop shops, and they were removed and they put the PATH station in. So it was one way. The Port Authority sort of legitimated the project by having the train station there.
So doesn't the Port Authority then have the main power? How come Silverstein seemed to have equal power
here? Well, they did for many years, but then right before 9/11, 6 weeks before 9/11, the Port Authority was moving to get out of the real estate business. And so they decided to lease the Twin Towers, the 10 million square feet of office space, to a developer. Silverstein won the bid. It was a 99-year lease for $3.2 billion in late July of 2001.
And the Port Authority was, which still had jurisdiction, is overseen by the governors of New York and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was George Pataki, Jim McGreevy, mm-hmm. definitely not New York City people.
Right.
Were they seen as outsiders?
I think there was a lot of debate in the city over who should be the primary constituents overseeing this project. And you had the Port Authority, you had Silverstein, and you also had the city that had no legal right, you know, because of the Port Authority's involvement, but clearly the city wanted to be involved. So that created even more tension. This strange ownership, new public-private partnership, made it even more complicated.
Pataki had particularly grand ambitions for the space.
Mm-hmm.
What did he want?
Well, he wanted to rebuild quickly. He also wanted to rebuild the office space, and he saw an iconic tower as an important part of the response to 9/11. He named the tower Freedom Tower not long after it was first conceived. And he also had his own political ambitions. You know, at the time, he was thinking of possibly running for president, and so he saw that this project could be a cornerstone of that effort.
My guest is Elizabeth Greenspan. Her book, Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center. You write a lot about boundaries, especially in the days following 9/11. At first, the city was blocked off below 14th Street, then Canal Street, then Chambers Street, and so on. And with the moving boundary, the people had memorial mm-hmm. tributes that they were spontaneously putting up. They moved as well. What does a shifting borderline say about the scope of Ground Zero?
It was constantly being redefined, and it shows how different people saw the space, especially early on. Depending on who you talk to, they would define just the boundaries of the space differently. Ground Zero could be all of New York. It could be, you know, six blocks in Lower Manhattan. And that was really interesting to me as I was trying to understand how different people were making sense of this.
Well, WNYC was in the general area, and we were homeless for quite a while
mm-hmm.
because, so many things were down. The telephone lines were down. All the telephone lines had gone under the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
Transmitters were lost from the top of the World Trade Center. So and we felt there was this terrible smell whenever we went down to that area. That was one of the boundaries for us.
It was. And other people I spoke to, too, they would tell me this is where you will begin to smell it. And for them, you know, at some point that was at Canal Street. And so for many New Yorkers, that was the line dividing Ground Zero from the rest of the city. And then over time, you know, that boundary shrunk in, but the site itself was always walled off. So you always had at least a couple blocks immediately around Ground Zero that were acting as a de facto public space where people could come to understand what this place was and what was happening here.
And put up temporary memorials,
yes.
Both official and unofficial. But you also say the sentiments behind these tributes were quite varied in their attitude. For instance, you write about 4,000 paper cranes that were sent by Japanese students to symbolize peace, but right across from them were calls to bomb Afghanistan and other more violent reactions. Did that mix of opinions on how to commemorate the attacks ever subside?
No. I mean, I think the fact that you saw that so early, this was in the first weeks after 9/11, in some ways the responses just became more political and more varied as time went on. But that was also what made it interesting, and there was a dialogue really happening. People were exchanging different points of view.
Although nobody was suggesting invading Iraq.
Not yet.
There were also official, if temporary, commemorative spaces throughout the rebuilding process. For instance, the viewing tower. Wasn't that controversial?
Yeah, the viewing platform that went up in December of that year, it was initially a civic project, but then a lot of residents got upset because it became such a tourist draw. It was drawing thousands of people to the site every day. People felt so strongly that they wanted to see the site, and so there were lines, and they gave out tickets, and so it acquired a certain kind of almost amusement park type vibe, even though people were often very somber when I spoke to them on the viewing platform. But it was one more piece of the controversy over ownership.
So you came to New York immediately after 9/11 from Philadelphia, where you were a grad student.
Yes.
To study this?
Yes.
To talk to people, find out what was going on?
Yeah.
And was it changing constantly? For example, were people upset when the memorials that they'd set up, the flowers, the teddy bears, the candles, were taken away?
Yes. They started clearing them roughly 1 year after 9/11, and often I saw people would pick up the memorials and the signs and the banners that volunteers were putting in boxes, and they would put them physically back on the fence until, you know, they were told that some of them were being preserved, and in some cases museums were collecting them. So, but then in other cases they were being thrown away later on.
And then there were a lot of tourists coming to New York specifically to see the site.
Yes, absolutely. And so the fact, you know, for many New Yorkers and downtown residents, I think a year later, they were at a very different place. But for other people who were coming from around the country, this was the first time they were seeing it. And they wanted and expected to see a kind of raw destruction zone still.
Well, we at this radio station was back at 1 Center Street at that time. And so whenever I'd be walking in the streets, I would see these tourists with a kind of lost look in their eyes. And I knew what they were going to ask me. Where's Ground Zero?
Right.
And unfortunately, I probably, being one of those callous New Yorkers, I'd say, why do you want to see a hole in the ground?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people did. I mean, it was really powerful. They had seen it in photographs. They'd seen it on television. And I think making that personal connection, I mean, it continues to be powerful for people.
And they were coming not just from the United States, but from all over the world.
Yes. I would never know when I approached people and I had a questionnaire that I used. And I never knew where someone would be from, you know, and what language or what accent they might be speaking with when I approached them.
How long after this did the whole matter of the Islamic Center come up? Because that's another matter of ownership.
It is. And that was more recent. This was in 2010. So it was many years later, but a lot of the same threads of questions of ownership and boundaries, you know, caught fire and exploded on the blogosphere and on television and at the site itself. There were protests that played out over the course of a couple of months.
So it wasn't just the site itself. In this case, we're talking about a place that was blocks away.
Right. It was two blocks on Park Street. And I think if you're there, you understand what two blocks means more than if you just hear that. And so part of the difference and difficulty was that nobody knew what that meant. And then people started attaching Ground Zero Mosque, which wasn't accurate, but at the same time, it was sort of close enough to fall in that gray zone.
Were people upset that there were all these street vendors selling stuff to make a couple of bucks?
There were. People were upset. And at one point, they created a ban of having street vendors on the very immediate blocks around the World Trade Center site for that reason.
Elizabeth Greenspan is an urban anthropologist currently teaching at Harvard University, and she writes regularly about Ground Zero for The Atlantic Online. She's also written for The Washington Post, Harvard Review, and other publications. And now she has a book called Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in this hour, a filmmaker, writer, tells the story of growing up in the shadow of his prodigy stepbrother, only to become his caretaker when he became schizophrenic and homeless. Plus, director Destin Daniel Cretton and Brie Larson, his star in Short Term 12, a film about a facility for at-risk teens. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC support comes from Incredible India, offering travel experiences in every season and diverse climates, from majestic Himalayan heights to tropic rainforests. More information available at incredibleindia.org or 800-953-9399. Rattlestig Playwrights Theater, presenting the inaugural Theater Village Festival. Five different works by playwright Lucy Thurber, running simultaneously in five different venues in the West Village, now through September 28th. More at theatervillage.com. WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our list of diverse supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, call Senior Director Lori Pracher at 646-829-4477. WNYC salutes the arts. Join us in supporting local cultural organizations, including Incubator Arts Project, presenting experimental theater by New York artists at St. Mark's in the Bowery, Performing Arts Center Issue Project Room, developing and showcasing musical, dance, and film events, and NACL Theater in the Southwestern Catskills, featuring original work and offering drama classes, workshops, and residencies. For more information about arts in New York, click on wnyc.org/events.
We are back with Elizabeth Greenspan. Her book, Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center, published by Palgrave Macmillan. David Rockefeller first envisioned the area to be a world financial center, and there is a financial center right across the highway. But he saw this as a symbol of commerce and American business leadership. Did the vision make the space vulnerable to a symbolic attack?
That's a good question. Early on, I'm not sure that they were thinking of that, but certainly by the 80s, there was a sense that this place was vulnerable to attack, and there were internal studies that found that to be the case, particularly in the garage. And then in 1993, there was the first attack on the World Trade Center. So for many years now, there's been a sense of this place as a target.
And you mentioned that Larry Silverstein had bought the lease of the Twin Towers just 6 weeks before the attack, and he had pledged to bring change to downtown. What was he planning to do?
He wanted to modernize the office space. It had been initially built, you know, over 30 years before, so he wanted to modernize the space, and he was still formulating his plan, so no one knew exactly what that meant when the Twin Towers were destroyed.
There was the problem, as I mentioned earlier, that a lot of office space was going unrented at the time. In fact, there was kind of a crisis in real estate mm-hmm. at the time. Was that a concern?
Yeah, not for him, though. I mean, I think he really saw the area as offering a lot of opportunity. The Twin Towers, you know, took many years to initially run out when the Port Authority first built them. But by the 90s, they had become profitable. So he was going back to that era and thinking that he could bring them up and modernize them and find new tenants.
Of course, all of that changed after the attacks. And 2 days after the attacks, he was already working on an insurance strategy.
Yes.
What was that?
Well, he was claiming, in order to maximize the payout, that the attack counted as two separate attacks, so that each plane into each tower was two attacks, which would have doubled the amount of money that he would earn from insurers.
And he didn't win that.
No, but it was something in between. He was given roughly $4.5 billion, which was more than for one attack, but less than two.
Well, he did have something of a valid argument because there were two buildings. If one of them had been destroyed, he would have lost one building.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this was an unprecedented event and in some way, and so everyone was acting, you know, off the cuff.
But everybody seemed to hate Larry Silverstein at the time.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't make some of the wisest decisions. I think being so aggressive early on to consolidate his control, he held a press conference within weeks saying that he would rebuild all of his office space, and that wasn't the place that a lot of people were in those first weeks. The rescue workers were still searching for bodies. You know, we were about to embark on a war, and so the idea that he was going to go forward with commercially developing the land, I think, struck some people as premature.
You write that today, architects and planners look at the Twin Towers as textbook examples of what not to build. You claim that this was part of why so many architects bid to rebuild the site in the first place. But was their eagerness really out of aesthetic concern? Wasn't this a big opportunity for any architect?
Absolutely. This was going to be the most high-profile commission in the world, you know, for right for this time. And so I think everyone was thinking about opportunities architecturally, but also from a planning perspective, to really do something new and innovative with this space.
And originally it was projected as a complex of buildings.
Yes.
That's no longer the case. And Silverstein was unhappy with the placement of the site as well as its symbolism. What bothered him?
He was upset about One World Trade Center, Freedom Tower.
Is it still being called Freedom Tower?
It's still colloquially being called Freedom Tower, One World Trade Center. It's in the northwest corner of the site, and that's where Daniel Libeskind put it as part of his master plan. But this was the farthest point from Wall Street, as well as from the transit hub that they're building at Fulton Street. And so Silverstein wanted to move it to the south corner where it could be closer to those locations. But Libeskind and then Governor Pataki believed that the building should stay in the northwest corner.
And Governor Pataki was the main advocate for calling it the Freedom Tower,
yes,
rather than One World Trade.
Right.
And Silverstein would have liked One World Trade, which is what it finally has come to be known as?
Yes. He was always interested more in a commercial skyscraper than building a symbol. And so as the symbolism has fell by the wayside a bit, I think he's been more pleased.
Then there's the whole matter of making it 1776 feet tall.
Yes. And that was also a remnant from Daniel Libeskind's master plan. It's the only real design piece that remains from his conception of One World Trade Center.
Well, his plan has been totally abandoned. And yet he said he thinks the reason this project will be good is because it went through a baptism of fire.
Yes. I mean, he is really an advocate and a believer in democracy. And so these days, now that many of his battles have been won and lost and are completed, he celebrates the process that we've gone through and the competing interests and the compromises that have been made.
Well, now that this huge building that not everyone finds particularly attractive is nearly completed, will the debate move on to what it does to the New York skyline?
Yeah, I think the debates are going to continue. You know, I think this piece of land is so charged and powerful still for people that even though pieces are now being completed, I think there will be debates for years to come.
The Empire State Building was built in months, if I remember correctly.
Right.
How long has it taken for this building to be erected?
It has been 10 years now.
Now, what's taking so long? Is it simply that they had to put in all of these safeguards to protect it against future attacks?
That's part of it. The safety concerns are enormous, and it has made for the building to be much more expensive than other skyscrapers in the city. There was also a lot of underground infrastructure work. They're building transportation lines through the site under the tower. So there was both that initial in-ground work and then the tower itself.
But the mall that used to be under the towers, that's gone?
That's gone. There'll be an underground museum, but the shops will be upgraded.
My guest is Elizabeth Greenspan. Her book, Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center, published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about the museum and the memorial.
Sure.
It was agreed from the start that there would be a memorial. I have bumped into the architect of the memorial, a young man, who this was his first major prize, a victory or assignment. And he told me that it has been a torturous experience for him.
Yes. Michael Arad, the young architect that you mentioned, was in his early 30s when he first got this commission. He, too, has more recently come around a bit and I think is realizing the value of completing the project, even though he had to make certain compromises and even though the battles were brutal, as he said.
And what were the reasons for those compromises? His design isn't particularly controversial, is it?
Well, it changed. So initially he had galleries that were underground and he had the names of victims being listed underground. So people would descend into the space where he imagined it would be quieter and more solemn to view the victims' names. And now in the version we have now, those names are at grade around pools at street level. And so that was a huge radical change from his vision. And I think it took him a long time to come to terms with that.
We had earlier memorials like the one in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Has that been a model for what we've seen down there?
Yes. The greatest pattern was initiated by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which was the first to name each victim, in a sense, or each soldier in that case. And so the Oklahoma City Memorial has a chair for every victim. And here, this was one of the requirements of the memorial to list every single individual by name.
We mentioned the museum. Mm-hmm. The drawing center was supposed to be relocated there. There were theaters that were projected.
Yes.
Why have they all gone by the wayside?
There was controversy early on with the drawing center and also a not early museum that was supposed to be at the site called the Freedom Center or the International Freedom Center. And that was eventually banned from the site by Governor Pataki after it raised a lot of protests and controversy from the blogosphere about what exactly its content would be. And it became very politicized and polarizing. So the drawing center got caught up in that, and it was seen as not necessarily bringing something, you know, patriotic or a virtue in that regard to the land.
There were fears that some show somewhere in the future might be found to be unacceptable to some of the families of the victims.
Yeah.
They didn't know whether the drawing center would have that kind of show, but
There was a risk, right. It could promote discussion or controversy in that way.
And then we have the LMDC. They just add to the complication?
Yeah. This was a group that the governor and the mayor created to oversee the rebuilding process. But because there were so many parties involved, it was always a little bit unclear what the LMDC, what kind of power they had and what exactly their role would be. And so at times they were overruled by the governor, for instance. With the Freedom Center, Governor Pataki came in and kicked them out over the LMDC's recommendation. And likewise with the master plan competition that Daniel Libeskind won, Pataki overruled them. So there was conflict there, too.
Could this ever have been done without conflict? We have a realization that this is a space where people had died. But you say many downtown residents just wanted their normal neighborhood back. Family members of the victims were concerned that any rebuilding would happen essentially on top of a graveyard.
Yes. I mean, I think conflict was inevitable. And because there were so many groups who were concentrated and came together over this one piece of land, and they had such competing understandings of what it was and what it should be, particularly early on. And it wasn't clear how we would make room for all of those perspectives.
And now we're a dozen years later, in April of this year, more than 50 new fragments of bodies were found during the construction process. So are some groups still unhappy?
Yes. I think there are definitely family members who are not happy with the development of the site commercially, as well as the way that the memorial and museum have gone forward. But that's the nature of a project like this. You will have people who are unhappy.
And when will it be completed?
The buildings will be completed over the next few years. I've heard different dates. 2017, 2018 are the times that people are telling me now for everything being completed downtown, but we'll have to see.
Is it 1,776 feet high because of the antenna on the top?
Yes.
So they could have faked it. They could have made it 1,777 feet tall by simply adding 1 foot to the spire.
They could have, but that symbolic height was very important to Daniel Libeskind, among others, and so they made sure to get it right.
And then there was the problem of finding people who'd be willing to move into a place that many feel, no matter how protected it is, and this is really a fortress, that it was still going to be vulnerable to future attack.
Yes, absolutely. For years, it wasn't clear that there would be tenants for One World Trade, which is one of the reasons that everyone was so concerned about this building. And then in 2010, there was a huge coup, really, for the Port Authority. They had Condé Nast. They worked with the Newhouse family to move Condé Nast from Times Square to One World Trade Center.
Condé Nast just keeps on moving around the city.
They do.
So is Condé Nast right now the only committed tenant?
There are others, but they are the anchor tenant, and they are the ones that has brought additional cachet and are helping perhaps bring other tenants to other buildings at the site, too.
Are there special security concerns for the office space?
Well, There have been. The New York Police Department raised concerns back in 2005, which caused a redesign of the tower. And so it's been outfitted with the top of the line best security. And I think they're working to keep things safe at the street level, too, with different protections for bomb blasts and things like that.
And that's where Skidmore, Owings & Merrill came into the picture, where they started redesigning the, ignoring the Liebeskind design and coming up with all of these safeguards?
Well, so Skidmore, Owings & Merrill came in when Larry Silverstein hired his own architect. He always had the right to do that, which is one of the confusions early on. So he hired David Childs at SOM. He did a redesign. It was after his first redesign then, months later, that the NYPD came in and said, okay, this has to be actually redesigned a second time to keep it safe.
So who's paying for all of this?
That's a really good question. The Port Authority is funding quite a bit of this. Some of it's come from insurance money and some of it's being raised privately. There's a Memorial Foundation that's done a lot of private fundraising for the Memorial Plaza and the museum. So it's coming from a range of sources. And the total price tag is not yet clear, but it's somewhere in the range of $15 to $20 billion.
Wow. And there were some people who saw a connection between the Port Authority's announcement that it was raising bridge and tunnel fares.
Yes, and the Port Authority has denied that it is using that money to rebuild the Trade Center site, although it's not clear where exactly all of the funds are coming for that.
Hasn't there been some disagreement between the Port Authority and Maya Bloomberg's 9/11 Memorial Foundation?
There was. That was one of the most recent conflicts that affected the museum, and it delayed the museum opening for a year over who exactly was in charge of the construction and the construction costs, because the Port Authority owns the land, but the foundation run by Mayor Bloomberg runs the museum. And so finally, after many months, they reconciled, but it doubled as just a conflict between the city and the state, as you noted, and so it delayed the project for over a year.
I wonder whether there are any lessons to be learned from all of this, because it's been a torturous road.
It has been.
I mean, why was it less of a problem in Oklahoma City?
There were far fewer people in Oklahoma City. You were not trying to redevelop the land commercially at the same time that you were building a memorial. They moved the building across the street, actually, that had originally been on that site. So they didn't have the same kind of competing demands. So that's the main problem, I think.
I would think also when Timothy McVeigh was arrested and executed, that seemed to put an end to the whole thing, whereas our world is still feeling the legacy of 9/11.
Yes, I think 9/11 remains very unresolved. And even though we are moving forward and completing pieces of the World Trade Center, that does not mean that the conflict and controversy and questions that 9/11 raised have been resolved in any way. And so, you know, that continues to play out.
And does that mean you'll continue to be writing about the situation?
We'll see. It's been a long number of years, as you said, but I'll certainly be continuing to follow the project.
Now, before you go, a listener has written in to our show page saying, the memorial is super sanitized, no indication of the violence that happened there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. The tower, you know, the pools outline the Twin Towers' footprint, but there isn't any remnant of the wreckage or the destruction. That will be in the museum underground.
Well, wasn't the feeling that this would be a place for people to meditate and then you could have the other stuff elsewhere?
Yeah, they wanted a kind of serene, open public space. And I think that's still the hope, that when the security can be removed a bit, this can really be an integrated part of the city.
Elizabeth Greenspan's book is Battle for Ground Zero, Inside the Political Struggle to Rebuild the World Trade Center. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Greenspan will be speaking and signing books at the New School on September 10th at 6 p.m. That's at Woolman Hall at 65 West 11th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. More details on our show page at wnyc.org. Up next, Peter Van Zegezer, who will be talking about becoming the caretaker of his long-lost homeless schizophrenic stepbrother. Then later on, in our second hour, director Lee Daniels and screenwriter Danny Strong discuss their film, Lee Daniels' The Butler, about a black man who worked at the White House over the course of 8 administrations throughout much of the civil rights era. It was the big hit of this weekend's film openings. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.